This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-Africa news and world developments. I'm Yehis Wuhib in Washington, and coming up on Africa News Tonight...
A wave of attacks on security forces in northeastern Kenya has alarmed local officials, some of whom are calling on the government to arm ordinary civilians. The government says that will be too risky, but it's promising better protection.
That's Mohamed Yusuf reporting from Nairobi. Details coming up also. After an attack on a military base in the Puntland region yesterday, according to Somalia's president, the army is in hot pursuit of Al-Shabaab militants. And wildfires swept through a southern coastal tourist destination in South Africa, killing one volunteer firefighter. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, Somalia's president says the army is in hot pursuit of Al-Shabaab militants who attacked a military base in the Puntland region yesterday. Nearly 50 people were killed and 20 wounded. Reuters quotes a statement from President Mohamed Abdullahi Farmajo that says, "We must show no mercy with Al-Shabaab and that they will pay for the attack." Militants assaulted a military base in Af-Urur, about 100 kilometers south of Bosaso, capital of Puntland. It was the deadliest attack yet by Al-Shabaab on Somali forces. Al-Shabaab claims it killed more than 60 soldiers. A wave of attacks on security forces in northeastern Kenya has alarmed local officials, some of whom are calling on the government to arm ordinary civilians. The government says that would be too risky, but is promising better protection. Mohamed Yusuf has more from Nairobi.
After weeks of attacks, local officials in northeastern Kenya are threatening to arm civilians. The officials blame the national government for failing to protect them. They say they are losing essential services after teachers and health workers stopped coming to work. Barashil is a member of parliament from Garissa County. He says locals are tired of terror attacks and concerned about the future of their children.
You know, you cannot always be killed and maimed by armed terrorists, and yet we are not being protected. We have lost teachers, we have lost medical staff. Now, I mean, we are not getting those basic services. So why should we be suffering for the last almost 4 years?
Shill and other four legislators from Northeastern have called on the government to arm the community to defend themselves against Al-Shabaab militants who have claimed responsibility for the recent attacks. Kenya police spokesman Charles Owino told VOA the request cannot be implemented, but the government will recruit and provide more security forces to guard the population. Richard Tuta, a homeland security expert, says the population can be armed, but the right procedures have to be followed.
Arming the community is not a bad concept, but how they will be armed, the process towards arming them. Like, for instance, there is a law, as far as Kenya Police Reserves are concerned, that there is a systematic way on how it should be done, right from recruiting, vetting those who have been recruited, training them, giving them equipment, and having a structure of operation. If it is done that way, then it will be okay.
In the last 3 weeks, Al-Shabaab has killed 17 security officers. Some of them were killed when their vehicle hit roadside bombs. Civilians have died as well, including a teacher killed last week in the Fafi area of Garissa County. Attending a memorial service held for the slain security officers Thursday, Kenyan Interior Minister Joseph Nkaiseri said the government will hunt down the terrorists behind the attacks.
Criminals and terrorists whose despicable action caused loss of these lives, we have only one message for you. You can run, but you can't hide. One way or the other, we shall get you, and when we get you, you will pay the price.
George Musemali, director of the Center for Risk Management in Africa, says some parts of the country are getting dangerous even for the police.
Even the police, you talk to the police on the ground, they are saying there are some certain areas they cannot go to patrol because those areas are
dominated by the Al-Shabaab. And unless we take drastic action to stop this, then definitely we are seeing Al-Shabaab will be gaining more ground in northern Kenya, and this is not going to be to augur well for the country.
The attacks come less than 2 months before Kenya holds presidential and parliamentary elections. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
European police and naval chiefs say those responsible for human trafficking in Libya should be charged with crimes against humanity. Many migrants often are physically abused, raped, robbed, and detained before being put in boats or rafts for Europe. To find out more, VOA's Jody Kapowa spoke with reporter Josephine McKenna in Rome.
Well, there was a meeting between European police and naval chiefs in Rome late Thursday. Admiral Enrico Credendino, the head of a European naval force that is charged with combating trafficking in the Mediterranean, said this is an international crime, a crime against humanity, and it should be recognised as such, particularly because we had 5,000 migrants die in the Mediterranean last year. He said we don't even know what's going on in the Sahara, but we can assume that that figure is even higher. But it's his concern also about what's going on inside Libya as migrants try to make their way from Libya to Europe. We also had a comment from Europol's Robert Kropinko, who said it's time to also note the traffickers' actions to really see that this is a reflection of something much greater than it's been fully appreciated in the international community.
Now, Josephine, if the charge of crimes against humanity is approved, would this be leveled at the smugglers that are often arrested in Italy and elsewhere in Europe, or would this be aimed at those in Libya who might head the smuggling operations?
Well, it sounds like their focus is on Libya itself. Now, to actually try and undertake any kind of investigation to determine who is responsible, to try and identify the traffickers, as we know, that would be a very difficult operation. How do you do that in a country that is being run by militias, where there is widespread lawlessness, where the migrants themselves are terrified even to talking to aid organisations like Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, when they've sent teams in there to see how people are doing in these centres where they're being held? People are most of the time too frightened to actually come forward and discuss what's really going on there. So it's all well and good to make these kinds of statements, but is there any way to bring these people to account? It doesn't sound like it to me.
Now, I understand that police in Italy have cracked a ring that they say was involved in prostitution, human slavery, illegal immigration. It runs the gamut. What happened?
The police in Sardinia, the island of Sardinia, in particular in the town of Cagliari, charged 13 suspects who are alleged to have run this operation involving human slavery, illegal immigration, and exploiting women for prostitution. The operation arose from complaints that the police received from young women from Ghana and Nigeria. They told the police that they were being held against their will. The migrants themselves had come from these African countries, were taken to Libya, detained in camps, and then transported to Italy aboard boats and then forced into prostitution. And this particular racket seems to be part of a system that has branches in both Libya and Nigeria, according to the police, that actively recruit young women, often involving voodoo rituals and threats against their families. It sounds like a very intense process, taking advantage, the police said, of the vulnerability of these young girls and imposing physical and psychological manipulation to force them into sexual activities. In one case, there was a death threat against one of the women's sons who was left behind in Nigeria. And there was also concern that there was active recruitment going on of these women via Facebook, promising what was supposedly legal jobs in Italy, but of course, once they got to Italy, being forced into a very uncomfortable and criminal situation.
That's reporter Josephine McKenna from Rome. She spoke to VOA's Jody Capua. A volunteer firefighter died today from burns after wildfire swept through a southern coastal tourist destination in South Africa. The ongoing fires were made worse Wednesday when a powerful storm hit the Cape Town area and fanned the flames. 10 deaths have been blamed in the storm. The region has been in the midst of a prolonged drought. The Associated Press reports water supplies are running low in the town of Nizana and surrounding areas. Residents had been told to try to collect rainwater from this week's storm. Helicopters and planes are dumping water on the fires, which has destroyed hundreds of homes in Nizana and hundreds of makeshift homes of poor residents in Cape Town. The fires also led to the evacuation of thousands of people. Sixteen past the hour, you were listening to Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. French President Emmanuel Macron is the driving force behind a pending UN resolution to create a military force to combat extremism in the Sahel. The 5,000 troops for the force would come from African countries in the region. But the proposal is part of a bigger plan by the new French leader to spur economic development in the Sahel and France and reduce the migrant flow to Europe. Reporter Catherine Field is following the story from Paris. She spoke to VOA's Jody Capua about Macron's plan.
What Emmanuel Macron has at the front of his mind is several things. First of all is security in the Sahel region, whether it be Islamist insurgents, whether it be separatists, whether it be in particular migration. Now, these are the two big issues that are always at the front of Europe's mind at the moment. Plus, Emmanuel Macron, he sees really pretty much through the eyes of an investment banker. So he sees trade and business as opportunities. And in a lot of ways, you hear him talk all the time about youth training and private economic investment. So he sees possibilities in the Sahel region, high population, younger population that need training. So he feels that if he gets more money in there and if he can get security sorted out there, then that region of Africa has actually got a future. But he realizes he can't do that on his own. France just doesn't have the finance, doesn't have the capabilities to do that as well as having a military force stationed in the Sahel country. So he realizes he can't do it on his own, that the European Union will go so far, you know, the European Union has just made 50 million euros available to help support the Sahel countries, particularly on security. So he's had to go to the United Nations. So that's what he's hoping, that by going to the United Nations, it's going to internationalize the problems in the Sahel countries. And he's also hoping that they'll give more money, not just for security in the region, but also to help train different countries' militaries and how they go about, whether it be just simple civil defense or the larger issue, which is insurgents and separatist movements.
Many of the analysts we've spoken to say there won't be peace in the Sahel until they solve the problem of unemployment and social reform. So he seems to be in line with a lot of what analysts are saying.
He does seem to be in line there, but always the problem when you're a French president and you're talking about the Sahel countries is always this back thinking of it, is this France, is this the old France of the 1960s and 1970s that wants to keep those Sahel countries as a colony in all but name? That's always sort of the fear when France says these sort of things. Emmanuel Macron has been pretty consistent in this. And you know, let's look again at one of the first things he did once he became president was to go to Mali. And by having gone to Mali, not only was he going to see what French troops were going through there, but also he was sort of, if you like, underlying the fact that France is supporting rule of law and the democratic process in these countries, and knowing that it is very fragile and that you're not going to get young entrepreneurs, you're not going to get people to go out there to teach, to train, not just the military, but also in universities and technical colleges, unless you have that security and that democratic base. So, yeah, he's really talking a new talk, but, you know, it's early days yet. We have to see whether he's going to walk that walk as well.
That's reporter Catherine Field in Paris. She spoke to VOA's Jody Capua. Unemployment, widespread corruption, and harsh police treatment of citizens are cited as key factors contributing to extremism in Tunisia. The International Republican Institute, a Washington think tank, looked at the gap between the expectations raised by the 2011 revolution and continued grievances of ordinary Tunisians. Luke Wagner spoke to VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi about the findings and recommendations for countering violent extremism in Tunisia.
There are three particular things that I'd like to mention. The first one is extensive police harassment. And there were many different reports of individuals in more traditionally marginalized communities that are being targeted by the police, which is creating high levels of dislike and mistrust among the security personnel. The effect of that is that it erodes a lot of the trust in the very institution charged with protecting these most vulnerable Tunisians. It's also furthered the divide between citizens and the state. Second major finding is high levels of corruption. And the reports of corruption ranged from petty corruption, such as bribes and demonstrations of nepotism on the local level, all the way up to the perception, at least, of grand corruption up to the national level. It's important to note here, too, that a lot of these mentions of corruption do suggest is the perception that Tunisians have that their state is not necessarily a legitimate protector of their rights, is not necessarily a legitimate actor when it comes to expressing and resolving a lot of their grievances. And then the third major finding is insufficient and bad governance. It's what led a lot of people to protest in 2011, but regionalism has been made worse, particularly in light of a lot of the promises that were made in the 2014 campaigns by political parties and candidates who said, we've heard your cries for freedom and dignity in 2011, and we are the respective party that is going to address these grievances in particular. And so because of this, Tunisian expectations in the interior rose dramatically. These expectations were not met, and in fact, their grievances have become worse because of an increase in expectations.
Following the revolution, young Tunisians were looking for better economic opportunities. How did the gap between the expectations raised by the revolution and the continued grievances of Tunisians when it comes to economic opportunity contribute to the rise of extremism?
Where the government of Tunisia has really failed is in their communication of the challenges and the grievances that they know that a lot of Tunisians are feeling, and they're also not communicating their specific solutions to a lot of these challenges, which is what a lot of in Tunisia, youth in particular, are really looking for.
What does the Institute offer in terms of recommendations to counter the vulnerability to violent extremism in Tunisia?
The first recommendation is certainly to encourage the police to work with the citizens in addressing grievances to violence, or grievances that often lead to violent extremism. It's essential that the government also works with all aspects of the Tunisian society. That ranges from the local government officials, to civil society organizations, to the religious community. The second recommendation is that the Tunisian government has to effectively engage its citizens as the representatives of the Tunisian society. This is important because the Tunisian government needs to regain legitimacy in a lot of these more marginalized segments of society. They need to be seen as a legitimate force. The third recommendation is that the government has to continue to address the issue of corruption. It needs to promote policies of transparency. It needs to initiate a lot of the efforts to share information and make public resources and public services accessible. And it also needs to continue its efforts to identify and bring to justice a lot of the high-level perpetrators of corruption, which lately the Tunisian government has gotten much better at. They need to continue that effort to be seen by the population as a government that cares about the prosperous future of its citizens as opposed to corrupt actors that may try to take over and take authority in the country.
That was Luke Wagner of the International Republican Institute in Washington. He spoke with VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi. Democratic Republic of Congo President Joseph Kabila has elevated a controversial former police chief, General John Numbi, to the rank of national hero. Numbi is one of 17 Congolese officials targeted by U.S. and EU sanctions, and he is widely considered the principal suspect in the 2010 murder of a leading Congolese rights activist. Rights groups say his elevation exemplifies the Kabila administration's defiance of international pressure on human rights. William Klaus reports from Kinshasa.
President Joseph Kabila signed an order in May declaring General Jean Numbi and seven other police officials national heroes, but the decree only came to public attention earlier this week. The Congolese human rights group, Voice of the Voiceless, has expressed outrage. The group believes General Numbi played a key role in the 2010 murder of the group's founder, Floribert Chebeya. Chebeya disappeared shortly after being summoned to a meeting with General Numbi, who was then the chief of police. Chebeya's body was later found, while his driver, Fidel Bizana, is still missing. Numbi was suspended as Congo's chief of police after Chebeya's death, but 2 years later, a military court declined to examine his alleged role in the murder. VOA spoke to Rostam Manketa, the current executive director of Voice of the Voiceless. He said he was shocked and very disappointed to learn that Numbi has been made a national hero. He said Numbi is considered by all defenders of human rights, as well as the families of Chebeya and Bizana, to be the number one suspect in their murders, which Manketa described as a targeted and planned state crime. Another leading rights group, the Congolese Association for Access to Justice, said it is deeply concerned by the president's decision and urged an independent, impartial and exhaustive investigation into the allegations that continue to surround Numbi. Government spokesman Lambert Mende defended Numbi's elevation to national hero status, telling VOA that Numbi has not been charged with any crime and has only been accused of wrongdoing by private individuals and organizations. But Numbi is also one of 16 senior Congolese officials that the United States and the European Union have hit with targeted sanctions since last September for their roles in violating human rights and undermining the electoral process. The US and EU claim that Numbi remains an influential advisor to the president despite having no official function, and that he led a campaign of violent intimidation to get pro-Kabila provincial governors elected last year. Numbi has not responded publicly to the allegations behind the sanctions. Manketa says that honouring Numbi is further evidence that the Kabila administration intends to defy pressure on human rights.
Mais le fait qu'il soit admis dans l'ordre des héros nationaux,
Manketa says that Numbi's elevation as a national hero proves that the Congolese state is not prepared to take into account all the allegations made about the general, both nationally and internationally. The targeted sanctions include asset freezes and travel bans within the United States and EU. Donatella Rostano, director of the European Network for Central Africa, a coalition of European civil society groups, believes the measures will have a dissuasive impact on other senior Congolese officials.
Because bank accounts, their families live in Europe. They come to Europe to get medical treatment. They have an intense life, most of them, in Europe. Sanctions mean that these people will be forbidden to travel here, to come to Europe, to actually have that kind of life that they used to have. So it will impact their daily life.
Polls were supposed to be held last November, but were postponed, and no new date has yet been fixed. The government has not yet formally responded to the latest raft of sanctions against nine government officials and military chiefs, which were announced in the last 2 weeks. But last month, in an interview with German magazine Der Spiegel, Kabila described the measures as actions that perpetuate neocolonialism. William Klaus for VOA News, Kinshasa.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehis Wuhib in Washington.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in. You will be glad you did. I guarantee it.